The three of us have been working on immunization studies for nearly 10 years. And some of you longtime immunization program managers may recall talking to Ann or I way back in the day, 1999, when the Institute of Medicine first really took a look at vaccine financing in the public sector. And they came out with the report calling the shots. And our role in that was talking with state and grantee immunization program managers and their staff to really seek to understand the challenges in running an immunization program at that time and in public vaccine financing. And I remember back in 1999 thinking, wow, this is so complex. And now we look at each other and go, those were the golden ages. Now it's crazy. So we had our work in 1999, and we're also involved again in representing the state perspective in 2002 with another IOM effort, financing vaccines in the 21st century. And just very briefly, a couple of key recommendations that came out of those. Again, we're talking nearly 10 years ago, recommending increased 317 funding for new vaccines, 317 in state funding increases for adult immunizations, expansion of insurance mandates, many others maybe more related to program operations as well as vaccine financing. But certainly, even back then, people were predicting that these were serious issues and we needed to take steps moving forward. So last year we were approached about, let's take another look at this, do a similar type of study, talking again with folks in each of the grantees to sort of do an update to those prior studies. So our purpose was to document immunization policies among CDC immunization grantees and to describe some current challenges to immunization programs. Our conversations were pretty comprehensive, covered vaccine financing as well as a lot of things in program operations, but in keeping with this topic of this session, we'll focus on vaccine financing issues. We conducted semi-structured interviews with immunization program managers and sometimes designated staff in 57 grantees, the states, six cities, and one territory. And we did interview transcripts and used those transcripts to document policies and identify some themes and common challenges. Today we'll be reporting for the 50 states and DCs, so sorry to any other cities that might be out there. Back in 1999, vaccine supply policy was fairly straightforward, and we were able to actually characterize each state under a single category. It's gotten a little more complex and a large, as you, many of you know, a number of states now have different policies in the public and the private sectors. So as I present this, let's just remember that for today, we're going to be talking about vaccine supply policies for private providers. And we have the states grouped here. Kind of goes from left to right, the least expansive to the most expansive. Back in 1999, we had 19 what we call VFC-only states, and now in the private sector, that's expanded to 23. The VFC plus underinsured, what some of you might remember seeing as VFC enhanced or other names, are in those middle two columns. Oh, there's my pointer. The select designation means there are certain vaccines excluded from that category. And I think it's fair to say that states that are in the select group wish they weren't, would rather have one, you know, coherent and consistent policy across the board for all childhood vaccines. For different reasons, it's not working that way. And then to the right, those are our universal purchase states, many of them now universal purchased select, so certain vaccines are exempted from that universal purchase status. Since our earlier studies, Wyoming has been added to that universal purchase list. Many other states have shifted to the left, used to be full universal purchase, and are now universal purchase select or some other type of supply policy. So what's affecting either the changes or people maintaining a particular type of status? Certainly the biggest one is the cost and the pace of new vaccine recommendations. Anytime you're talking about expanding beyond the VFC-only population, that takes money. And so, as you know, with some of the recent vaccines were quite expensive, and they came at a fairly rapid pace for a while there, and it was difficult for programs to deal with that. Certainly, 317 funding levels impact how much a particular grantee is able to purchase, and also the issue of getting 317 awards at different times during the year, and that played into the comfort level of states to really be able to plan ahead with what they were going to be able to do with those kinds of funds. Different states have different traditions and commitment to contributing money for the purchase of childhood vaccines. And certainly that came into play in terms of what a particular grantee felt that it was able to do. Trends in the underinsured have absolutely skyrocketed as a big issue. When VFC first started, the underinsured seemed to be a fairly contained category. Now it has gotten very large and very complex. Everything to do with, you know, lacking coverage for some of these newer adolescent vaccines, you know, very high deductibles. So it's that has really become a major player in states feeling that they would or would not be able to cover some of these additional populations beyond the VFC kids. And finally, FQHC availability and delegation of authority goes hand in hand with this underinsured issue. You know, FQHCs are not equally available across all states and all areas of states. And importantly, not all FQHCs will take immunization-only referrals for underinsured kids. Often the case is a family that comes to an FQHC seeking immunizations needs to enroll that kid as a patient in the practice. So it's not necessarily the greatest referral site in that sense. And I think as we have gone through the years, some of those issues are now becoming more apparent. And that's another thing that states are feeling may affect their ability to expand beyond VFC. So other sources of funding beyond VFC and 317 for childhood vaccine purchase, and I want to give you some categories and ask you to work with me a little bit here. So we group these into three categories. Significant funding just meant that there was a pot of money that kind of could be counted on and was expected. But I need to point out here, significant ranged from $200,000 to $50 million, and I'm being exactly honest. So we need to figure out what's the happy medium and what's a reasonable kind of cut point. And it's tough because it can't be a, you know, there's no magic number, maybe a dollar per kid or something like that. But significant means more than limited in this talk for right now. So I know some people that are on the low end of that 200,000 to 50 million range are not feeling like they're getting significant non-federal funding at all, and I completely am hearing that. Importantly, this money comes in different pots. Some of it is general funds. Some of it comes from taxes on payers, MCH block grants. Sometimes other state agencies are kicking in money, and we did not include SCHIP funding in here. Some states have some, but it's pretty limited, and those are very small allocations of dollars, often for a narrowly targeted population, outbreaks, some other things. Also, a couple of states had more periodic, hey, if we have a surplus, we'll throw some money your way, but really nothing that could be counted on for planning purposes. And usually we're talking in the less than $100,000 range for these, and then other states that just have none or virtually none. So when we map this out, we have the states with no or minimal funding in the purple, the limited funding in the green. And I think one of the things to highlight is if we think back earlier to these calls for you know, maybe expanded participation in states for funding childhood vaccines. Yes, that's happening in some places. In a couple states, it's happening in a very large way. But in a lot of states, it's really not. Factors that affect non-federal funding for childhood vaccine purchase, often it's a champion within the state government or the legislature or the bureaucracy that really keeps the importance of childhood immunization on the agenda and pushes that. A lot of it is just pure economics. And I know in Michigan we feel the pain of having tough budget times year after year. Sometimes there can be some pressure or assistance from manufacturers in pushing for the earmarking of funds for vaccine purchase, for sometimes a particular vaccine, sometimes just a little more of an open line on that. Kind of the same deal with the non-federal funding for adult vaccine purchase, although certainly the amounts were less in the significant category, substantially less. So again, the states with none or minimal funding are in purple, and you'll notice that there are a lot more of them here. And then the limited in green, and the significant funding in blue. Certainly the factors that affect non-federal funding for adult immunizations largely begin with the mission of the immunization program and to what extent leaders have decided we are really going to focus on childhood immunizations versus trying to really push for a way to expand into some of those adult immunization activities. Many states had traditional adult immunization programs that they felt strongly they wanted to continue. And then again, depending on the extent of unmet need for the childhood vaccine purchase, states did or did not feel that they could spend money on adult vaccines. State mandates to cover childhood immunizations certainly feed into this topic of underinsured. Here in this graph, there are in the blue, we have a couple of states where the mandate is in the form of mandated payment for vaccine purchase. Other times we're talking about a coverage mandate, a mandate for vaccines to be included as part of insurance benefits for payers that do business in the state. And then in green, 18 states that have no mandate. And I think it's important to note state mandates come with a lot of caveats. Their targets are not always expansive. Sometimes they cover 0 to 5, sometimes they cover 0 to 2, sometimes they cover the vaccines that were recommended at the time the mandate was enacted, which, you know, for some states is, yeah, we have DTP, don't even have the A, and MMR and polio. But at the same time, though there was a lot of recognition for the need to expand mandates, at the same time there was some concern about opening up immunization policy and a little concern that that might open the door for perhaps some anti-vaccine activity and groups and, you know, would it be a winner or a loser? There's a lot of concern about the federal ERISA exemption for self-insured plans and multi-state plans. So even if you have an insurance coverage mandate or a mandate for payers to kick in, there are still some plans doing, you know, covering kids in a particular state that aren't going to be subject to that. And then the availability of other mechanisms to have insurer contributions to vaccine financing. As an overview of our findings, I think it is really important to point out there were a lot of things that have improved since around 2000 or 2002, last time we've talked to people. A very big one is a feeling now that there is adequate VFC funding to cover all VFC-eligible kids. That wasn't always the case. People felt very uncertain about whether those funds would be there. And as recent as a few number of years ago, there were still some states that felt like they were in that position. But as of the time this fall that we talked with people, everybody really felt like that challenge has been overcome, and they feel like we're good on VFC funding. And I think for a lot of states, they have an overall stability in their VFC provider population. Not all states are where they want to be, admittedly, but what we did not hear was widespread fear of providers, you know, dropping out in droves or anything. It was very much of a, you know, we have a stable provider population, we're working with them to distribute vaccines and get them in VFC eligible kids. So that was a very good one. There were some common challenges and concerns that we heard. As I said at the beginning, immunization programs have become increasingly complex. There are a lot of requirements. With every new vaccine, there's provider education, there's distribution issues, there's measurement issues, there's the, you know, logistics of running a very expensive program and keeping track of budgets, and that's all gotten quite complex. And so I think a number of program managers talked about priorities and the adequacy of funding and their ability to really keep things moving forward. The transition to a centralized vaccine distribution system was filled with some bumps. Things are getting better. And I think providers expressed their main concerns as being able to really maintain positive relationships with their providers. They're the face with those provider sites that are getting the vaccine out there into kids, and so making sure that they have that, and also having sufficient data to manage their programs, and that's moving forward. And also with vaccine, with the funding allocations and the spend plans, a challenge was understanding the review process and making sure that, again, an ability to manage the program, an ability to plan and know what was coming forward so that they could feel comfortable that, hey, we're going to have a VFC-enhanced program and know we're going to have enough funds, we're going to be able to do this, we're not going to have to stop in the middle and say, ooh, we're going to have to now select out another vaccine from this program. And I think those interactions with providers in the states are so crucial, and state programs want to be able to maintain that positive relationship with providers, which includes feeling good about where the program is headed. You know, we heard a lot of good suggestions on where there's a need for states to work together and have some federal leadership to move forward. Continuing to advocate for increased 317 funding to cover some of these kids beyond the VFC eligibility criteria. And also continuing to work toward improved allocation and award processes for 317 funding so that it's clear what funds are going to be available and allow states maximum knowledge of what they're going to get so they can plan, so they can award contracts, so they can work with their partners in delivering this. Federal leadership's also needed to expand our options for what to do with these uninsured kids and to deal with the ERISA exemption from coverage mandates, really look at that definition of underinsured and see what other options might be available. There are also some state-level barriers to vaccine purchase. Not being able to purchase off the federal contract is a frustration with many states that, you know, it costs more money than it should for some purchase. There's barriers to program staffing, hiring freezes, budget years that don't match, things like that. And also looking for federal leadership to assist in predicting future needs as new vaccine recommendations are expected to come online and how those can match with, you know, the annual budgeting processes. And I think to close, there's what we heard from the guarantees was looking for a partnership with CDC, working together to articulate objectives that foster efficiency, focus on the highest priorities, identify and solve problems. There are a lot of opportunities. There are 50 state examples out there. Everybody's developing strategies. Field test and disseminate some of those so we can all learn from each other. And recognize areas where we need uniformity, but also places where we want to promote some flexibility and develop some strategies to do that. And finally, to support testing of new ideas and dissemination of successful strategies. Thank you.
thank you very much. Thank you very much to all the speakers for a really, really interesting session. We have a few minutes for questions, if people have questions for our speakers.
Question for Dr. Fried. When looking at those, the range of numbers that you had for physicians' practices, how much they were paying for vaccine, and you noted that there were quite a large range. Did any of your data indicate whether some of the real outliers and the practices that were paying seemingly a lot more than you would expect were buying vaccines not directly from the manufacturer but from someone else like a distributor, or did you not capture that?
There was a range. Some purchased directly from manufacturers and some from distributors.
Question for Dr. Fried, but also for Dr. Cowan. One of the slides said it's not yet a problem, a major problem with pediatricians, the price and reimbursement of vaccines, et cetera. The question I have for you is, are those the canaries in the mineshaft that are signaling that there is going to be a problem unless we address it? Because my concern is that slide could be misinterpreted as we don't really have a problem, which seems to not agree with a lot of what's said, you know, by AAP and a variety of people at me. So I'm just curious as to your opinion. Is this an early warning? Are these the...
I think that the issue is that canary is bad business practices, to be honest with you. And I think the Academy is now concerned on where they can intervene. And I think that they've actually, in the last 2 months, once they became aware of these data, have change their own strategies of how they intend to deal with these issues. So that's the best I can answer.
Hello, thank you all for your presentations. I'm Shannon DeZubin with Novartis Vaccines. And Sarah, I wanted to know a little bit more in terms of the detail you have in your study. You indicated which states are having trouble with their policy and having to go to the select policy, which I understand is a place where most states don't want to be. And I know that Prevnar really pushed us to that situation where states were getting into select status. I was wondering if you collected data that went into more detail about the trends now and where we stand and which vaccines are going into the select status and which populations, or if that was not part of the detail in your study.
We do have that kind of detail. You know, it's hard when you want to show some categories and make some pretty maps to do that. As a general rule, the not 100% true, but as a general rule, the more expensive the vaccine, the likelier it is to be select. And newer ones are also a little bit more difficult to fit in. It doesn't always hold true because, again, sometimes other things will happen to make funds available for a particular vaccine. We do have that. I think as we work to disseminate this, more of that detail will be available in formats that allow for a little bit more time to present that detail.
And just a follow-up question. Mm-hmm. The data that you presented today was on the private sector side. Did you also collect the public sector finance decisions?
I think we mostly did, yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Can you say a little bit more about dissemination and how we might find out more of the details from your findings?
Right. I think certainly we want to do a number of pieces. I think we're committed to working with AIM to develop reports on this. It's hard to, you know, when you think of all the topics that we covered, and thanks to many of you in this room, I recognize some faces. You spend a lot of time on the phone with either Ann or myself. And what we don't want to do is come out with a 100-page report that has everything in it that nobody will read. But I think it will be important to pick out key pieces, disseminate that as reports to the stakeholders. We're also trying to recognize beyond the places we would automatically think of. You know, certainly CDC folks will be interested in that. I think the states themselves. Are there other natural audiences that would benefit from hearing some of this? Governors, the National Governors Association, legislators, things like that. You know, we're well prepared to do the academic publication piece, but that may move too slowly for this. So that will be in addition to the other efforts. And I think our commitment is working with the Association for Immunization Managers to figure out what are the right mechanisms to present that, and then tailor the information for each of those pieces so we get the right level of detail matched with the right audiences. And if you have ideas, I would love to hear them because, you know, the plan is not set yet.
All right, well, I'd like to thank everybody for attending this session, and I'd like to very much thank our speakers for an excellent session.